Hello, everyone. We are forced once again by the Yotun to worship the ritual on Netflix. Luckily, it was able to bring us some special guests. All this and more for Horror Movie News.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
Sid, don't you blame the movies.
Where the lights at? Where the lights at?
Movies make sight. More creative.
Oh,
I forgot because it drops with the beat. Yeah. I don't even know my own show, guys. Welcome, everyone, to Horror Movie News. We are on episode 19.
Yay.
Isn't that crazy?
That's awesome.
It just started last October. We've come so far. Welcome, everybody. I am your host, Anthony Becerra. I'm not just one, I have plenty of hosts here, though. But I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Becerra. You can find me everywhere at, not Tony B. That, sorry, I changed that. Tony B. Tony underscore. Tony B. Tony underscore. I know. And Carrie.
Hey, it's okay. You're allowed to change the name on your social media. It's your social media.
Yeah, it's mine, guys.
And hey, how's it going? My name is Carrie Lane. You can find me online at Carrie D. Lane. That's K-A-R-I-D-L-A-N-E.
Hey guys, I'm Oliver Jenin. Follow me on all social media platforms at Ollie Dreamer.
Hey everyone, this is Chauncey K. Robinson, and you can find me on Twitter at Miss Chauncey KR.
Right on. And with us, we have special guests, Bruckner and Andrew Schulkind.
Yes.
David, can you tell everyone where they can find you on social media?
Oh yeah, I'm on Twitter at BruckMacken.
Right on. And Andrew?
I'm on all the networks. A. Schulkind.
Right on.
Sweet.
This is my inner engineer talking. Can you just get that mic close to your mouth?
Right here.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Right on. Yeah, you really gotta kiss the mic a bit. Right on. So, real quick, do some house cleaning. Where you can find us? So you can find us at youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork and join us live, or you can just watch it afterwards. You can also follow us on our show Twitter at horrornewsptn, as well as on the Popcorn Talk Network website, popcorntalknetwork.com. And lastly, on Apple Podcasts, just type in Horror Movie News, find this little cute little picture of us, and that's us. And go ahead and leave a 5-star rating and tell us everything you like or dislike about the show. All feedback is welcome. And you know, a 5-star rating, and apparently the other stars just don't work, so don't even try it. Yeah, you'll be cursed by the children. Right on. So on to our first segment, we have The Abyss. Pretty much, what films have we been watching? And preferably horror, but anyone want to kick us off?
Did everyone look at me? I was like, whoa, wait.
It's weird to look at Carrie, you know? I'm just like, how about our guests?
Yeah.
Yes, first off to bat, let's do it.
What have you been watching?
I just saw Annihilation.
Yes.
Same.
Incredibly badass.
Yes.
I had a good week. I watched Annihilation. I watched Phantom Thread, which I hadn't seen. I watched Get Out again.
Yeah.
I finally caught Black Panther.
Ooh.
I saw, and I watched Mute. Yep.
Oh, I've been wanting to watch Mute. Yeah, I've been tracking that in my head lately. What would you think of it?
Of Mute? It's interesting. It's like a mixed up structure. I think people have been a little hard on it personally. I mean, the idea of a sci-fi movie that's not a sci-fi movie, that it's like a little bit of a slacker detective story in a sci-fi setting, I think is ambitious and cool.
Right on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And so on to Andrew. What, you
What have I been watching? I have children, so I saw Black Panther, and that was a huge success.
Yeah.
Nice.
Glad to finally support that movie. And I just finished Dark, which is
one
of my favorites. I mean,
yeah.
Rad.
Yes.
Right on. Yeah, I've been meaning to catch that as well. But
it's a do not miss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a child too. It's called AfterBuzz, pretty much. Keeps me busy, really.
Keep you up at night.
Yeah, full time. So well, weekends is when I really just try to cram everything in.
There you go.
Anyone else want to kick us off?
Well, I'll jump off of that. I also have finished Dark. I agree. Excellent series. Can't wait for the next season. I was on vacation, so I couldn't go to the theaters much, but I watched Dark Tower.
Ooh.
Finally.
Oh.
Right. I liked it. I thought it was fun. I think some people are kind of meh about it, but I enjoyed it. I started Elias Grace on Netflix. I mean, that's kind of horror-esque because it's a murder mystery, kind of. It's based on true... I'm like, wait, I had it on IMDb. If you guys don't know about it, it's Margaret Atwood, who also did Handmaid's Tale. So 19th century Canada, a psychiatrist weighs whether a murderess should be pardoned due to insanity. Ooh. So it's actually, I am enjoying it. I want to see where it goes, though. And then I'm watching the anime Kakegurui, and there'll be an after show on that. I'll talk more about that later. It's so bizarre and weird. I love it because it's just so crazy. And
it's actually really scary.
It is very scary and violent.
I get really creeped out by the fan service and the facial expressions, but yes, I'm here for
those
it.
Those faces are like intense. But yeah.
I think we all saw Annihilation, which was
amazing.
See it.
Didn't see it?
Oh,
I haven't seen Black Panther yet either.
Well, here are the spoilers.
Well, Natalie Portman is just freaking phenomenal, along with the entire female ensemble. Tessa Thompson. Oh, I love Tessa Thompson. But definitely recommend it. I will not spoil it. There's some really beautiful scenes, and it's also it's beautiful, but it's like scary at the same time, you know. So I totally recommend that. And I've also watched Southbound.
Yes.
And I guess we can talk about that more later. But I got really excited because there's a scene in Southbound. I was talking about to you before the show. With an ice cream parlor in a little town called 29 Palms, which is where I'm from. I was born in 29 Palms, so that was really, I got so excited. I was watching Southbound by myself, and I was like, oh my god, I gasped when I saw, the scene of this ice cream parlor. It's called Foster Freeze. It's amazing. Soft serve. Ugh, yes.
Foster Freeze.
But, yeah, so that was about it for me, and I'm also watching the anime. I can't say it. I don't know. What about you, Chauncey?
Well, I saw Annihilation, and I really enjoyed it. I had some sort of existential crisis throughout.
Oh, really?
I do that a lot, but especially with this movie. And
Can I ask, what about it triggered it, or?
There was just a lot in terms of, without getting too much into the spoilers, but, the whole idea of the fault in our, molecular, selves, and then the question of, that hashtag that they've been going on with it, of what's inside. And if you watch the movie, I think there's a double meaning of that, of what's inside versus what's inside the shimmer, which is this thing that basically comes from the lighthouse. So there was a lot of that. And there's the question of nature. And it's, to me, I just found it super scary because, for me, I don't usually find sci-fi scary at all. I usually like ghost stories or things like that. Because sci-fi, I don't really... it's a whole thing about the person in the year 3000. Oh, there's a tentacle monster in 3000. I don't care. I'm not in 3000, right? So it doesn't involve me. But in the terms of this, the fact that it could happen, the question of nature and something and how to, that creeps me out. Mm-hmm. So I think nature's pretty scary. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, just look at natural disasters. Terrifying.
And the other movie, I watch a lot of vintage horror. So another movie I was checking out was The Hollywood Phantom, which is on Warner, which is released through Warner Archives on their DVD collection. And it deals with them pretty much getting rid of this old movie studio, and that there's a phantom on the movie studio, and he's killing people. So it's a little play.
That's awesome.
And you get to see a lot of old clips of old Hollywood, which is really cool, between the killings.
Damn, it almost sounds so lame, but that reminds me of a Phantom of the Megaplex.
On the DCOM. They probably thought the same thing. Came out in the 1970s. It was very cheesy.
Yeah,
but
it's a Disney Channel original movie called Phantom of the Megaplex. It's hilarious. Right on, so I'm up now. So, yeah, so I saw The Signal, which I thought I really enjoyed. I gotta say, you did the, I believe it was a Crazy Love?
Yeah. Crazy in Love.
Transmission
the
first one. Crazy in Love. Mm-hmm. And, man, it was fantastic. I really enjoyed that film. I love how, the separate transmission focused on different points of views of, the characters that were involved. The first one, Crazy in Love, is mainly, the female character. And the middle is, they call it the jealousy monster. So it's, it's a boyfriend who's going after the woman. And then it's a woman's, side piece, I guess.
Yeah,
you could say.
Her lover, yeah.
Yeah, her lover, and that's how it ends and everything. And I love how it's the humor in the third and the second act was pretty great. But yours was, I felt the first short was very, sincere, very, how she's walking with her headphones home, and she's walking through the halls and all those bodies on the ground, and she has her headphones on. I just thought it was so beautiful. I thought it was so cool. I also saw Annihilation, which I thought was really great. I really enjoyed it. Natalie Portman kills it. That one scene, you see, it's in the trailer, so I can say it. That one scene where she's just holding up the gun and just shooting, and then her face is just so killer instinct. I was that stuck with me. I was And then I feel like the ending is so
when they actually wanted to change the ending.
Yeah.
Really?
There was a whole thing around it. I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah, I was about to say, it was so cerebral, like, and so, like, stimulating. And, like, that little dance that she has with that, it's just so good.
Carrie's like, what the hell are you talking about?
It reminded me of
this movie.
I did hear about that part, though. Yeah. Like, wanting to change the ending, but luckily the director had control over it. So they're like, nope.
Mm-hmm. And Alex Garland, that was, you know, one of the things in the question of Natalie Portman's character, too. I know we're all saying, like, the badass woman and things like that. There was a question of whether or not she was sympathetic enough. And I think it was really good that they made it so they kept her the way she was, because she was a flawed character. And usually women don't get to be flawed characters in film. It's always the guy of, he's a brooding man with his man pain and things of that nature. But
man pain.
Yes. It's a thing.
Yeah.
So, but it's nice that she got to have her pain in this film. That was, I thought the interpersonal with the science was awesome.
Yeah. You learn that from the entire cast too, the other characters as well. They're all like treasure. They're kind of flawed treasure.
Yeah, they
all have... mention that in the film.
Yeah. And their lives don't start
exactly
just when the movie starts. It starts before.
Oh, right. That's
plot,
right. Yeah, I remember that. And also, like, the especially, like, the third act, I got, like, really, like, 2001 A Space Odyssey vibes from it. How it was so, like, mesmerizing, and how she's, like, looking into that certain thing. I won't say what, but, like, because I can't even explain it, to be honest with you. But I thought that was, like, really cool, and that leads me to, I actually ended up watching over the weekend 2001 A Space Odyssey again. Yeah.
Of course.
I'm like, lucky enough to live somewhere where we have, like, a home theater. So I've never seen 2001 Space Odyssey on, like, a big screen before. So that was, like, the biggest I've seen it. And my God. And it's on Blu-ray, too. And it still holds up today. This was, like, 1968, I believe. And it's still, like, the effects just look marvelous. Like, they still puzzle me, like, as in, like, how do they do that? Like, and I can't figure it out unless I go back and read my book on it. Because I was, like, obsessed with that movie for a bit. But, yeah, I saw that movie. It was fantastic. I also shared it with the roommates. And they also loved it. It was great. I gotta say, it's definitely, like, I feel like it's meant for, like, an acid trip. Like, this like this movie. Yeah, it's okay. Like, the 2001 Space Odyssey is ridiculous. Like, it's just, it's so, like, stimulating, and I love it. I don't know if you guys, have you guys seen that, right?
Oh, yeah. It's been a minute, though.
Yeah.
But I do remember it holding up. I do remember being pretty blown away the last time I saw it with just, like, the function of the spaceship, especially, like, the jogging scene where he's moving through it as it's rotating.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't... The end of it is a bit of a blur to me. I probably owe it another watch.
Yeah, the ending always gets a little... It's when he's, like, going through the infinite, and also he ends up in this, like, room, and he sees himself in different times. Anyways, that was good. All right, on to our next segment. I was like, I don't want to get into that. The Crypt. So pretty much what film you would like to share and recommend to everyone who would like to start it off? I'll go then. Alrighty then. So mine is The Void. It came out in 2016. It was directed and written by Jeremy Gillespie and Stephen Kostansky. And the synopsis goes, shortly after delivering a patient to an understaffed hospital, a police officer experiences strange and violent occurrences seemingly linked to a group of mysterious hooded figures. And those hooded figures seems to be like some sort of cult, and there's definitely some sort of, like, weird occult at play in the film. I really liked it because of, like, how mysterious it is and how they don't really give away too much about, like, the origins of why things are happening, which I enjoyed that. I was like, oh, I was okay. I wanted to know, but at the same time, it adds to, like, the charm of the movie, you know? There's also... It's also very H.P. Lovecraftian. Like, I thought it was really cool. I love Lovecraft and everything associated with that. That's why I love The Thing too much. A lot. The monsters in... There's actually monsters in The Void, and they're all mainly, like, practical effects. So it's just, like, kind of like a throwback to, like, the 80s horror of, like, how everything... There's very little CGI in the film, and I could appreciate it for that because one of my favorite films is... The Thing, so I was just like, oh, this is so cool. So if you like The Thing, definitely check out The Void. I believe it's still on Netflix. That's where I saw it, and definitely worth a watch. And that's my Crypt selection.
Carrie?
Sure, yeah. I was thinking about it, and throwback, and I did mention Southbound as one of my ones from before. But a new one I have is Existenz. Have you guys seen that one?
Yeah, I've seen that.
It is from 1999. It is with Jude Law.
It is, yeah, David Cronenberg.
Yep, David Cronenberg. And I was like, how do you explain this movie? But I like this one. A game designer on the run from assassins must play her latest virtual reality creation with a marketing trainee to determine if the game has been damaged. It's so wonderfully bizarre. It really talks about video games in terms of like what's real or not. And it's not like a regular game. The game thing itself is like almost kind of sexual. Like they're touching it in weird ways. It's like a blob thing that like you move part. It's just really weird. And then
and it connects to your back too.
Yeah. You plug into your body.
Yeah. And you have to have an implant in the in the lower back of you,
And it's just so
So there's some
weird
intercourse going on.
Looking up some pictures, thank you. And then I was like, what was the lady's name? Yeah, Jennifer Jason Leigh,
who also came out in Annihilation as Ventress. Yeah,
very cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it's listed as like sci-fi and horror, and yeah, it's just one of those. It's good action and sci-fi horror, and if you like video games and. But taking them to a different kind of space.
Awesome.
Very cool. And weird. And then, yeah, okay, this picture, kind of a
spoiler-ish,
but still, there's a gun in it, and they can't have, like, they need to get essentially through a metal detector kind of thing. So they make a gun out of literally organic material, as
fish
in
bones.
Skin and stuff, and the bullets are teeth.
Yeah.
And you remember that. Like, I've talked to the other people, and they're like, yeah, the teeth gun thing. I'm like, because it's just so weird.
Interesting.
But it's very cool. It's a very cool movie.
Yeah, and David Cronenberg's, like, known for his, like, body horror, so there's a lot of that going on, and, like his little, like, artistic style of, like, creating these practical, like, props that he does, like the gun, and also how, like, it goes in the back of his, like, that thing connects to his back. Yeah.
And it's just another thing, too. I was thinking, it's a really cool look at, like, what's real and what's not, too, of, like, what world are you in, which is very fun to pay attention to. You're like, wait, where are we now?
Okay. Well, mine's kind of like, I rewatched it this weekend, and I was like, at first I didn't really like this movie, but then rewatching it, I was like, huh, I actually really enjoyed this. It's Blair Witch 2016 by Adam Wingard. A lot of people, I know it's a controversial pick. A lot of people didn't like it. I don't know. Have you guys seen the remake? Because it's basically the third installment of the trilogy. So, but at first I didn't like it, like I said. But rewatching, I'm like, this is kind of fun. Like, they pull in, like, the little drone. But I'm also interested in what did you guys, our talented filmmakers here, what did you guys think? Have you seen The Blair Witch by
Have you seen it? You haven't seen it?
No, not the new one.
Well, I know Adam and Simon from, because we all worked on VHS together. Then they went on to do VHS 2, which is really kick-ass. So there was a conversation for a while about found footage and how to do it and how to riff on that for a second. So for me, watching Blair Witch was like, I felt like, and this is definitely me putting this on what they did, it was that, you know, they kind of remixed everything we learned in all these short bites, you know, through, you know, through the VHS movies. It was like the greatest compilation of all the coolest aesthetic sort of ways to spin found footage. So by the end of that, where you've got this really deep dive on sound, like the sound design is really incredible and it's hitting you from all sides, and you've got this really incredible immersive experience. I don't want to give away too much, but the way they engineer the set piece and the mechanic at the end of the thing you can or can't look at, I thought was like utterly fantastic. So I think that stuff, I think the execution of it is super fun.
Yeah, because it's gotten like a lot of mixed reviews, not as many good reviews, but I enjoyed it. I think it's like worth a watch for sure, definitely. And Adam Wingard, I love him in directing Your Next. Such a good film.
So I haven't seen that. I need to catch
that.
Your Next is really good.
Yeah, I've heard about it. It's on Netflix, right?
Huh?
I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix. Is it on Netflix? That's where I lived on for a while. Yeah, because also with like The Invitation, like I don't know, I grouped them all together, like The Invitation and also Your Next and also what's it called? There was one I saw recently, which was, it wasn't Your Next. It was, They Look Like People, kind of like that same kind of circuit on Netflix. But yeah, that's a good pick. I still haven't seen the Blair Witch one.
The reason why I rewatched it, too, is because I heard that they're developing, like, a TV series for Blair Witch.
Really?
Lionsgate. Yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah, because, like, there was
what
not...
What would you do as a TV series?
I don't know. Yeah, because I rewatched it because it ties into the theme of The Ritual, because Lost in the Woods. But also, I was reading that they were... Just recently, like 2 days ago, they announced that Lionsgate was. Yeah.
First Child's Play now. Blair Witch.
Oh, Child's Play too?
Yeah, they're trying to do a series for Child's Play.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see on that one.
All right, Chauncey?
Well, I'm going to be, I guess, a little bit more mainstream because it's it was 30th year anniversary. I went to the 30th year anniversary of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, The Dream Master. But also this week, it was the 31st anniversary of when the Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, Dream Warriors, was put out. So I would recommend both of those because that was what got me on the horror stint. And I just love Freddy Krueger. He's kind of like my Valentine, which probably shows I have issues with everything. But it's a really good one of the things that I got to see at the 30th year anniversary screening that was hosted by Screamfest LA. Mm-hmm. Rennie Harlan, who was the director of that, was there, and Bob Shea, the co-founder and producer of New Line Cinema. And one of the great things they were talking about, it really shows the power of like kind of the director in that sense, because he tells the story, and I had heard about it, you know, with the Never Sleep Again documentary, was that it was during the time of the writer's strike that this movie was being made. So they had they hardly had a script. And basically they just got together and kind of put the script together. And you kind of see that in the film, that it's very visual what's happening. And it was just a really great film. It was a little bit lighter on plot than the third one was, but in terms of just the visuals, and you had to imagine like it was like 1988 when it came out, so everyone was just like, oh my gosh, what is this? And like now we've seen everything, but certain ways and angles he was doing it, and with the whole the piece of souls, you know, like with the meatballs of the dead kids and stuff, was just, and Freddy's eating them, was just like some of the best things ever. And the Roach Motel, some of the like really, to me, like really awesome scenes. So I recommend like revisiting that for the anniversary. So
right on. Yes. Great recommendations. Yeah, I have to go stroll down Elm Street myself.
Yeah, just don't watch part two.
Part two?
Yeah.
That's what I was like, I gotta watch part two.
No, you can watch part two. Part two was good. No, I mean, comparatively speaking, lesser, I mean, part two was better than like a lot of other movies I've seen, but in terms of like all the series, it's probably the least good one.
And I'm also a sucker for like practical effects, so they're all about that, so like I'm so down for that. Alrighty then. Alright, so let's start with Andrew.
Alright, so The Crypt, I mean, first of all, I've got to do a little plug for The Vault, which is a movie I did with a friend that Dave introduced me to, Dan Bush.
Dan Bush.
Which was just came out on Netflix also.
Yeah.
Which was a fun movie. Super scary, I think. Creepy stuff happens at a bank, and turns out it's a bank heist, and I don't want to give too much away.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was like, wait, I have heard of this one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
James Franco is in it.
It was a fun one. And then also, I recently watched The Others, which is kind of
my favorite
Spanish horror. Super fun movie. It's just like, actually, it's funny we're talking about it now because it kind of reminds me of the kind of movies that Dave makes, because they're sort of like, it's as opposed to a horror that falls into to a trope or to a kind of like, even to a classic concept, it feels like something like a modern version of what horror looks like, because 2006 or something, I don't know what year it was, but the way that it feels like it's a movie, and then it's a horror movie, but it's not a horror movie first. It's just sort of like a really interesting character drama that has sort of thriller and suspense and all that interesting stuff, but then it's also super scary. Mm-hmm. Also, I saw it alone. It was scary.
I've never seen The Others. And it's only because someone spoiled the end of it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And it's one of those movies where the end is essential, and so it's like every time you sit down to watch a movie, you're like, well, I know where that's working, you know, so... Just such a bummer because I've heard that it's great, but yeah.
But I watch. I mean, you know what happens at The Sixth Sense? I go and watch that again.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah.
But I've seen it again. And I'm like, I still enjoy it. I don't know if it's as densely like as richly woven.
Yeah. Sorry, I was like looking at the picture. I'm like, yep, that one. That was
Nicole Kidman, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And I didn't know Spanish. Oh.
Yeah.
Horror.
That's, yeah.
So it was so creepy. Woods.
Usually,
how was. We looked at that movie actually for some spooky stuff.
Oh. Okay.
We didn't do anything that dense. Our woods were way more dense, but.
Yeah, the way I chalk up to like a movie that's kind of already been sort of spoiled for me is like I just try to enjoy the ride to the point to where like, oh, okay, so, you know,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, that sucks that it was spoiled for you. But what's your
film? I'm trying to think here, and I'm going back and forth, so I'm just going to throw out two.
Okay, perfect.
Two that people maybe haven't seen. One is a movie that I discovered with my roommate from the early 90s. This was something that we watched in college a lot, and I didn't have a lot of context for it. But it was an Italian horror movie called Cemetery Man.
Ooh.
Yes. Starring Rupert Everett, and it's completely buck nuts and surreal yeah. and fantastic. And it deals with the caretaker of a cemetery who mm-hmm. is perhaps slowly losing his mind as the dead are coming back from the grave. But it also deals with a lot of his personal issues. It's very existential. It's very surrealist. And there's an interesting thing with it where the interpersonal human problems are really dealt with yeah. a dramatic, melodramatic hand, but the violence is not. So the violence is so happenstance in the way that it's realized, and it has a very curious effect. But if you like giallo, if you like you know, Italian horror cinema, and mm-hmm. if you want to get really weird with the movie, I mean, I think at the time we laughed with it quite a bit, but yeah. I haven't seen it in probably 10 or 15 years. So I don't know how it, you know, how I would regard it now, but it's kind of a landmark for misbehaving in the medium for me a bit. And the other one I would throw out, that I've seen in the last few years is the 1981, Zulawski's Possession.
Oh my Neil, God. Yeah.
Which is just like completely out of control. Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to say anything else about it. Some people don't consider it a horror film.
I love that movie. Yeah. I just gotta say, that's one of those movies that like really gets, just thinking about it makes me happy.
I think that has to be, we have to classify that as horror, or you know, or regard it in the horror lexicon in a sense. But there's just so many fascinating things they do with that movie, and the performance styles are like ratcheted up through mm-hmm. the roof. So you've got actors doing really interesting representative stuff to get these points across, and the way it interacts with the camera, it's just a joy to watch. And probably, depending on your tastes, you may hate it or you may love it or you may not know how you feel about it, but I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, and the thing that always sticks with me too is the ending shot where like you see like Sam Neill's kind of like shadow behind the door. I just love that shot. It's like ingrained in my head forever, because it's just so, to me, it's so like monumentous. Like, it's just like, that's like, I don't even know what to make of it either at the end, but I'm just like, I just love it though. I just love seeing it.
If you're watching it and you don't know what to do, just stick it out through the subway scene. And then decide.
Yeah.
And that's all I'll say about
it. She goes ham on it. She goes like 1,000. Oh my God. Yeah. That's one of those earliest films that
yeah.
I recommended myself. Yeah. I was able to watch that one at the Egyptian, so I have been able to see it on the big screen, and it was such a pleasure to watch that too. And they had like a 35mm print of it, and yeah, great recommendation.
It's just so fun when a filmmaker will sometimes take an idea like way too far, you know. it's like the way Mike Myers used to treat a joke, where like you laugh and then they keep going with the joke, and you stop laughing and then you laugh again, you know. Or it's like, like Michael Haneke has this movie. It's the most pretentious title ever, but he gets to do that. I think it's called 71 Fragments of a Chronology of Chance. Huh. And there's an 8-minute scene of a guy playing ping pong with himself, you know, and just like off the wall. And he's incredible, and he's just like on a run with this ball. And, you know, at like a minute, you're like, oh, wow, this is cool. I get it. I'm getting something off of it. And then at like 4 minutes, you're like, okay, I got it. And then at like 7 minutes, you're like, this is brilliant. You've just come full circle around it, and you're seeing your life, you're seeing other people's, like all struggle is contained in this moment, and it's a total trip. But like, there's several of things of that sort, I would say, in the Possession movie, where they just take an idea farther than it should go.
Oh, okay.
And that's just part of what I get out of it, but yeah.
Nice.
That's nice, yeah. That's interesting too, because I went to this like weird hiking thing, it was like a sort of like workshop of like creativity and also positivity. Mm-hmm. And one of the things was that like, when you brainstorm, like the first three ideas aren't going to be great, but like when you keep going at it, like maybe the 20th or maybe even like the 30th idea you get is going to be so like much better than your original ideas. So kind of like how you said, they take it too far. Like your first ideas of what you're seeing is like, oh, okay, like that's cool. And then, but late, as it keeps drawing on, you're like, your ideas become more like profound and more complex. Like the more you experience the same thing going on. So I was just like, oh, that's interesting. I like that.
Yeah, it's always good when a movie confuses you.
Oh.
Or just throws you off, like, you know.
Yeah, because then you're just like, you're just like a deer caught in headlights. You're like, how do I react to this?
Start wondering about your life.
And like Annihilation.
Fill in the gaps.
Yeah. Right on. So that takes care of our two segments, and now let's just
get into our guests here. So before we jump straight into the ritual, I have a general overview of some of your work. So starting with David Bruckner. Not sure why I said your full name, but yeah. So you directed and also wrote the Transmission 1, Crazy in Love for The Signal. Mm-hmm. Nice. So would you like to tell us a little bit about your experience working on that one?
That was born out of a creative tribe in Atlanta about 10 years ago, and we were all doing a lot of theater at the time, and I'm going to give the super short version on it. I'll just say that it was like a very, we had a program in connection with this theater that we were working at where we would just make short films and kind of screen them at the theater space. And we just throw challenges out to the community. Like everybody tell the story of this picture, or go to Piedmont Park with a camera, guerrilla style, and shoot something, you know, with three actors and steal a movie and bring it back and we'll screen it. And we had a small but devoted audience of people that would kind of look at the stuff and watch it. And it was in that context that I started an Exquisite Corpse project with another writer where we just went and shot 20 minutes of a feature film and handed it to another director. And we were like, go. And Dan Bush, actually. And then Dan went away for 9 months, and he came back and with the same actors and everything. He's like, I put 40 more minutes on this movie. And he lost his mind with it. And then he gave it to a third director, and the third director looked at it, Jacob Gentry, and he was like, this is great. It's a total mess. But you guys have stumbled on some neat ideas. Like, what if instead of just going on forever, we start over and we call it feature film? So him and Alex Motlock, his producing partner, kind of proposed that to us, and we went out and shot this little apocalyptic sci-fi satire indie horror movie for $50K over the course of 13 days, and that's what The Signal is. But it's a weird
13 days
Rashomon-like, if you're familiar with that reference, multi-perspective triptych, and it's kind of a little experiment in genre filmmaking, but we are very proud of it. And the concepts and the ideas in it for us, I think, hold up, you know, many years. I mean, it was kind of, I think 2007, we were really interested in media fragmentation and the rise of talk news and 24-hour talk news. And I think all the things we were responding to there have only become more of a constant media divisive onslaught these days. So it still feels relevant.
I think. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, TV makes people crazy, pretty much.
Yeah, that's pretty much the conceit of the movie, if I missed that part, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, the TV drives you crazy.
And then, so jump forward to 2012, and VHS is released.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you did Amateur Night.
Yes.
Which personally is,
I was going to say, that's one of my favorites.
I was about to say, too. It's one of my, like, once
not
I...
Not just saying that, but for real.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because like, I saw VHS, ones. I was like, what is this? And we go, and the first one, they pop in the first, like, tape, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, cool. And then once you start seeing, like, the girl come out, she's like,
oh, the stare.
I had to look up like Amateur Night 1. I'm like, which one was that one? I'm like, oh, yeah, that one.
I like you. I was like, oh, yeah.
So creepy. Was that the first tape? I forget.
I think that was the first one. Tape.
So that was a really good one. I feel like it's
it
not,
started off well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like,
no, it hooked me,
When you think of VHS, you think of that. You think of Amateur Night. Like, that's the one, not only because it started off first, but it just was so, like, it just stuck with you. And, like, it was also developed into a film, wasn't it?
Or
like,
right, yeah. The Siren?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote it? You wrote
it? No, so these guys, Ben Collins and Luke Petrowski, wrote it. I developed it with them. And and then Greg Bishop went on to direct it.
Okay.
And it's pretty rad.
Yeah. I want to see it.
Yeah.
Where can you...
It's a little different. Actually, I don't know where you can get it right now. It was produced for Chiller Network. And I think I'm pretty sure it's on iTunes or something like that. But it's a little bit different. You know, the short is really lean and mean and pretty rough on, you know, the masculine behavior in it. It's sort of a toxic little experience. And I think the feature, you got to spend more time with these characters. And so it had to be, we just had to treat the material differently in a sense. But I thought the writers did a really great job of sort of handling the uneasy ideas that were at hand, but also making a really interesting, fun, scary movie out of it. There's a little bit more magic to it. It's a little bit, so it's almost like the short meets Nightbreed in a way.
Ooh.
It's kind of a reference point, you know. Yeah,
it's a good one.
That'd be a good one to come back.
I was gonna throw that out there, but I thought it'd be too esoteric.
Nightbreed, no way.
They had their special like Cabal edition screening at the Egyptian Theater like a few years ago or something.
I think I remember seeing that.
That was pretty awesome.
And then after that one, this is actually one that you both worked on. Mm-hmm. And you guys did Southbound in 2015 with The Accident, Yes. Right? That was a short. I was unable to catch this in time, but I believe Ollie, you saw it as well.
Yeah,
I love Southbound.
Yeah. Oh, you've seen it.
I've seen Southbound. I saw it at a. It's what? Do you remember what film festival it screened at in LA?
In LA, it was at AFI.
Okay, I know I saw it at a film festival in LA, and loved it. One of the few horror movies where I don't normally get scared with horror movies, but I don't remember what it was exactly. But there were parts that were actually scary. The home invasion, I don't normally like home invasion plot lines, and that one was really good. And it was one of the better anthology horror films where stories tie together and it doesn't feel like clunky. Mm-hmm. Like it transitions very well from story to story, and it's very interesting. Yeah.
Some of the stories like actually like kind of mirror one another. Yeah. It's really fascinating. And I have a question for you guys, because I was talking to Andrew about how like I had this emotional response to one of the scenes, and I'm wondering if you guys had any kind of like growing up, what really inspired you? Like, is there like a shot that's been like you've seen in a film that really inspired you and kind of like, oh, because my inspiration and my response to Southbound was seeing that ice cream parlor. And I was like, oh my gosh. And it really inspired me. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, this is where, because I'm from 29 Palms. That's where it was shot, or at least for that short. And so, yeah, I know I'm rambling, but it was really cool. I'm thinking, wow, 29 Palms, like desert horror, like that is a genre. So I was wondering if you guys had any shots and films that really inspired you.
Does a single frame stand out for you?
So when I was like 5, I had a babysitter, and I really wanted to stay up late. Maybe I'm 6. I really wanted to stay up late, and this is just going deep here, guys. Too early in the hour. And I really want to stay up late. She's like, all right, you want to stay up late? You're watching Poltergeist. And I was like, fine. And it like totally just the idea of like the, you know, the screen with snow on it and sitting in front of that screen, it like not only did it turn something on in me, but it turned me on to the idea of horror. And I don't know if I'd say horror necessarily, because I consider myself like a fan of movies overall, and horror is a piece of that. But I'm not a horror super fan, as some people are, but I think that there's something about that was just like, this turned me on. And it was something about how visceral horror movies are, like how it grabs you in a way that, you know, This Is Us or whatever other kind of like pick your more generic movie, you know, piece of entertainment works. And so, and that, and also the fact that I can see scary movies super late and still go to sleep.
Ooh.
I just want to riff on that, because I actually had a like Poltergeist moment when I was young. I was at my grandmother's house and Poltergeist came on the TV, and I asked her what it was, and she said it's a scary movie and then left me alone with it. and I had like that movie really did a number on me. Like I had problems because of that movie. I just was too young. It was way too scary. And I had, oh, I don't know. I had to be, it's very abstract, but I want to say 7. 6 or 7.
What if we shot the same broadcast?
That would be pretty beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
Connected through space and time.
Totally.
Just meant to be.
Yeah.
And Andrew, you touched on it earlier, but can you touch a bit more on The Vault
that
you did for Netflix?
So The Vault was for, I think, FilmRise is the, and now it's on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
So I think I'm not mistaken. Great movie. Super. David introduced me to the director, Dan, who was an outstanding, you know, again, a collaborator from Signal. And it's just an interesting experience. We shot in Atlanta, which is sort of like where these guys got started. And it was a great experience. It was fun. It was interesting because it was such an ensemble. Mm-hmm. And there were two, you know, there's sort of an upstairs. We always joke that it was like sort of like the horror Downton Abbey. Sort of like there was like the upstairs that was like one version of the story, and downstairs was in this kind of like creepy basement. It's like a whole other version of the story, and it allowed us to explore all kinds of interesting stuff from a lighting perspective, and also kind of from how we told the story. But there were a lot of voices on the movie, both in the movie and about the movie. But I think that that's something we're proud of, and it's cool to watch.
You're always looking for like the great horror conceit, like the movie problem that just works in a way. And Vault always had this, just the idea of a haunted bank. You're like, how come no one's ever done a haunted bank before?
Yeah,
because then you rob the bank, and then the bank goes on lockdown, and then you can't leave the problem. You know, because haunted house movies, the problem is always like, well, why don't they just leave?
Yeah,
when you just go out the front door, why in the world are you staying here inside this movie? But the haunted bank traps you in, and it's just a sweet conceit. You get to do genre blend. So, yep.
That's cool. So it's a whole horror heist movie.
Horror heist.
That's awesome. I got to check that out.
You should.
Yeah, I'm definitely. It's on Netflix. It's like easy access. Check it out, everybody. It's on Netflix. Easy access. Come on. All right. And that brings us to The Ritual.
Woo.
Ooh, my God. This film. So before we get into this, little overview of the film itself, we actually have the trailer. I know you guys have to if you guys want to. Oh, you guys worked about it. But yeah, let's go ahead and roll that real quick.
It's actually getting harder now to have a good time.
Speaking of Downton Abbey, it's Thomas, for fun. Right?
Yeah,
that's right. Oh. I watch it like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, the amazing Robert James Collier,
yep.
Yeah. This is the British trailer.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the British one.
Is it very different from the American trailer?
It's a slightly different angle on the marketing, yeah.
The fucking move.
British plays up the comedy a bit. Oh. The American trailer plays up the kind of nightmare quality of it.
Interesting.
All.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Rob would have loved this place.
Do you guys have like any overseeing of the trailers at all, or is it just kind of like, all right?
I think my experience on these projects is it varies from project to project, and it's usually circumstantial. But with this one, I think I have more input on the American trailer.
Oh, okay.
I've seen some of the scenery. It was filmed in Romania, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why Romania?
Because we couldn't film in Sweden where the film takes place because the days are short and it's very expensive.
Oh. Ooh, okay.
So we needed to find an affordable forest.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a really amazing place in Romania and a really awesome production services company. And just a good group of people that were willing to kind of do it old-fashioned style. Mm-hmm. You know, because you can go shoot a movie in the woods like right off the road. In something that looks like the woods, and if you point the camera in the right direction, you can get that feel, or you can go out in the middle of the Carpathians on top of a mountain and really lose your mind, and that's what we got to do with this.
Ooh.
I was just going to ask, how far in were you, and like, what was day-to-day in terms of like, if you're that far in, how did you get in and then get out and sleep? And
well, everything had to be staged out of Bucharest for about 3.5 hours, would you say, from Bucharest, from Civilization, and then cast crew, everybody's at like a single lodge on top of this mountain plateau.
It's like The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was a lodge? Okay. I was wondering, like, how do you guys stay out there? And was the environment, like the weather, was that like a constant problem at all? Was that
was the rain real?
It rained on days we didn't want it to rain.
Always.
And the rain in the movie we created.
Oh, how funny.
Cool. Yeah.
But then the snow was coming. Like, we couldn't, we were behind schedule at times, and there was no way to push because winter was just like, right up against it, you know, and it came early at one point. We were knocking snow out of the trees for concrete.
Starting fires, using leaf blowers, dudes on ladders with brooms trying to, like, clean up. And there's a shot in the movie when it's just like there's some kind of patchy snow that you can sort of chalk up the highlights, but there's some snow you can hide it.
Highlights is cinematographer talk.
Yeah.
Very, very technical before the day is over.
Yeah, we're gonna dive in.
You're actually our first cinematographer on the show.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Before we have great. Our first director, I believe, was Joe Lynch, who did Mayhem. We had him come in, and that was a good interview as well. Check that out, everybody.
I haven't seen that movie yet.
It's awesome. Dude.
Really eager to see it.
Bloody.
Yeah. Steven Yeun is like perfect on that. Also with Samara Weaving, she did a fantastic job.
From The Babysitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from The Babysitter. Oh, and The Babysitter. My God, have you guys seen The Babysitter?
No.
It's another Netflix one.
it's really fun. So the film is based off the book by the same name by Adam Neville. And so it's right here, yeah. and so let's just go through the characters real quick. I call them the backpacking bros. So it's Rafe Spall, who plays Luke, and he's like the lead character. Robert James Collier, who plays Hutch. Arshar Ali plays Phil. Sam Trotton plays Dom. And Paul Reed plays Robert, which is our first death. By the way, this is all spoiler filled, so it's okay. right on. I wanted to ask, so how long was filming this? Like, how long did you guys...
33 days?
Yeah, 30, okay.
33 days, which is pretty good for an indie. Like, they definitely stretched the budget. So.
And was everything on site, or was there some, like, did you guys shoot at a lot at all? Or?
None of it was on stage. All of it was in the woods. Okay. Yeah.
Because I wanted to ask, and Steve, if you can bring up the picture of the woods and the store. I think you have it up already.
Oh, so, yeah, those shots are gorgeous.
Yeah, when it's when you see like the store happens. And also but the woods, like, was that on site? Is that
so you all built
practical?
Wow. There.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know which picture you're looking at, but
it's a little dark. Yeah,
that
yeah.
shot is in the woods.
It's like towards yeah. the it's wow. towards the end when the Jotun is like chasing him and he's on the ground and he's getting flashbacks of like what's going on.
Yeah,
and it kind of like it was cool how like the store cup like pops up and it kind of like lights his way to like run towards like the light and stuff. So that was practical. That was like you guys made that. That's so cool. I was gonna say like that looks so amazing. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, there were some stuff that we some convenience store stuff that we shot in the forest, and then some forest looking convenience store that we actually shot in a convenience store.
Oh,
so we shot the actual convenience store. We first muddied it up, and Addie Corlea, who's a production designer, did an awesome job kind of making it look like it was within the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And then we slowly cleaned it up and then shot the actual scene. And when because we shot that very last. Convenience store was the last thing we shot.
Since it's based on a book, how much of it is, how similar is it, do you think, from the source material? And then, for example, like these kind of shots, are they described like that in the book?
Not exactly. There's not a convenience store in the book. Yeah, it's we found that Joe Barton, the writer, and myself experimented a bunch with how to kind of process the book into a movie because there's just certain things in the book that don't really translate, you know, to a movie. And mostly it's just because the book often is in Luke's head, is in the protagonist's head. So he's in this situation with his friends and they're walking through the woods and he's constantly remembering who they were, his friends, and what they'd been through. And so a lot of the experience of the book is you're sort of oscillating back and forth between who they once were and what they used to think their lives were going to turn out as, and then, you know, flashing into the reality momentarily where they're being stalked by this entity in the woods. And so the experience you get reading the book is, it's like the modern mixed with nature. And then in the book, the beast does cause these nightmare sort of flashes. It does get in their heads in a way. And so what we did was take a modern element and combine it into that nightmare conceit in a way. And so it was a way for us to kind of get that feeling on screen in a very literal way, because to make the movie where they're actually in this survival situation that's constantly cutting back to them earlier in life would have been a lot of backstory to uphold in a movie. It just doesn't work in cinema quite the same way it does in the book. So it was a way that we kind of interpreted it to kind of capture the spirit of the book. But there's differences, but I think for a lot of people that have read the book and seen the movie, I think it's, I'm generalizing here, but I think it's been regarded that it's a pretty serviceable, based upon, you know, the film is definitely trying to capture the spirit of the book in an earnest way. Yeah.
Good. Was there an element in the book that you wish you could have had in the film that you just couldn't do it? Or?
There's a black metal element in the book
that
is specific to the region and would have required us to go in depth on a lot of subculture when we didn't have a lot of screen time, but would have been pretty rad, I think. And so there are two black metal guys in some of the opening scenes that kind of flash. I don't know that you really pick them up. They actually cross behind Paul before he goes into the convenience store. Right behind Robert, they're sort of angels of death in a way, but that
is
kind of a nod slash apology to Mr. Neville that we couldn't work it out.
Nice. Dang. I know we were talking a lot about, like, before the ritual was released on Netflix, that it's kind of like the male version of The Descent, kind of. Just the similarities. Obviously, you're in a forest, not in, like, a hole with a bunch of blind, you know, cannibals. But was there anything, any inspirations that you wanted to incorporate into filming and the production of The Ritual?
You know, I think because this was based on the book, I think, you know, when I came on board, they had been developing the book for some time into a screenplay. And so there were several drafts of the screenplay. And so they had made some discoveries. So you're...
That's the Imaginarium.
Yeah, the Imaginarium Studios. Yeah, the production company. And so there's this sense of, you know, you're just trying to get it right. And it's more like you put things together in a way and you go, oh, hey, this has some similarities now if we do that to this other material over here. And, you know, it was... I think at one point when the script was coming to a close, we were like, it does kind of echo The Descent in a way now, mostly because of the way the front-end traumatic incident works. And we were like, that's great. Let's embrace it, you know, in a sense. And that's a great movie. And
it takes some inspiration in that sense.
But we looked at a bunch of stuff just where the imagery was concerned. Do you recall?
Yeah. I mean, I think we saw everything, every movie that has a forest in it. Mm-hmm.
Including the forest.
We did look at the forest.
Yeah. Okay.
I made the forest. So I was like, there was a lot of stuff. But I think the... it's funny when you're asking about references. I mean, Dave's been with this so much longer than I have because he wrote it and developed it, and then of course through editorial, and I sort of like show up. You know, we prepped it, of course, and then you know shot it, and then afterwards did some color. But as we're talking about references, it's funny. Like this, maybe it's just the stage in life. Like I feel like you've seen more than I have in general, but I feel like everyone, like as filmmakers, you have kind of like. I remember what I'm getting at is earlier in my career, I would kind of like think, okay, what about this movie and what about this movie? And now I feel like there's just sort of like an amalgam of movies of just kind of like, you know, movie water that you just kind of like grab stuff out of. And it's just sort of like appears and you hope that it hasn't been too literal a steal, you know, that you're like replicating something. But it's just sort of like it ends up being more authentic that way. And so that's when you have like source material, like a book that's rad. You can kind of click into something for a point of reference. Mm-hmm. So the stuff we looked at was super literal, like, you know, what does night look like? Which was a really big thing for me. It was like, how do we capture... And because in looking at forest, it was like, okay, let's look at forest. Now let's look at forest at night. And like, I wasn't really that impressed with anything that I saw of night in general. Even... I'm even looking at video games. Like, does this... Am I seeing like a CG version of night that I buy? And I was like, it always feels like you're trying to see faces... You're trying to see the different ethnicity of characters. You're trying to be able to identify characters between one, you know, from one to the next. So you have to be so up that I was like, well, let's do something different. And so that was why that. So my references were like, how dark can we make it? Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the challenges with making a movie at this point in time is that it appears on your phone, on your iPad, in a theater. And so then, like, you have to start creating other deliverables because you're so surfing the edge of what darkness looks like. Mm-hmm. And if you suddenly you're on a Delta flight. And it's like black.
Yeah.
It's worthless.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember the campsite scene where it's like, that was really dark, but you can still see them. And if you've ever gone camping, it's dark out. Totally. So,
And to me, like, I always remember growing up, like, my parents wouldn't close the door, and it always scared me that my light was on and that outside was dark. And I was like, anyone can see me right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
I was like, I had these shutters in my room, and there was a, we're going deep on some challenges. I don't know why, but like I had a curtain, like a blackout curtain, and then shutters. And if I forgot to close the curtain, I was just like, anyone can see me through the shutters. So like I thought about that in this movie because that was why
he talked about the shutters a lot.
I did because
it comes up all the time.
Because in the when we built these houses, we were like very specific about being able to see out, and the fact that anyone could see in is scary.
Because the go-to in production is you know you don't want to shoot nights the entire time, you know, because you get less, it's hard on the crew, it's hard on everybody. So the conventional wisdom is let's black the house. So we built those cabins in the woods, and then you cover it in black so you can shoot night for day, basically. And so we'd really fight for things like our production designer had built these cracks in the house, and Andrew had all this amazing like lighting setup outside and these awesome kind of giant flash mechanisms for the lightning, and you can see them when you're inside the house. So you're still getting the environment of the exterior when you're inside. So things like that, you know, you have to make a case to everybody that this is going to add three more overnights onto the production schedule just so we can get that look and that feel.
Right.
And it's worth it when it works.
Nice. Yeah, definitely. It looked, I gotta say, yeah, it looked brilliant. Like I was watching earlier today, and like when they finally find that cabin, and it's Luke who hears that noise before he goes in, and he's like trying to see, like, that's always so terrifying when you see the flashlight, and like you can see that the bit of light, but everything around is just still dark, and I'm just like, oh.
When we shot that, not that one, but there's another moment where he's shining his flashlight.
Yeah,
maybe it is that. I don't remember where it is in the edit, but we were, you know, we're on another night. No, it was after when they have their flashlights after Hutch goes missing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're shining their flashlights around us. So we're shooting it on a mountainside in the Carpathian Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a flashlight, and we had exposed it so we can just see the beam of the flashlight. And we're, you know, I'm just kind of like whipping around, just giving a ton of options, and then kind of landing, and then over here at landing.
It's just you in a flashlight and a camera alone in
the
woods.
Really?
Just doing this.
Getting all these like POV shots. Yeah.
And we were shooting in the, I don't know if you know this, but in Romania, it has the biggest bear population in Europe.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we had these snipers with us just in case, you know, like these hunters that would just kind of like hang around the periphery. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm doing this, you know, we'd been shooting for a couple of weeks, so you're not thinking about it anymore. And then like, boom, and there's just like a guy with a gun.
They were always on the outskirts, like hiding in the darkness. Like,
One time I went out to go to the bathroom in the woods, and I'm just like, there's like a guy.
You
right
think
here.
You're alone, and then it's the cigarette that gets lit in the darkness. Yeah.
Dude's like,
and you're, I'm glad you're here, man. Yeah.
That's awesome. I was hoping, this goes for both of you, if you guys can talk on how you went about setting the tone and the atmosphere of the film. Because to me, that I felt like that was like one of the scariest elements to the film. How it's like you're able to steadily intensify the atmosphere through the visual information that's given to us, and it's also what's withheld from us. I hope that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, it's probably a little bit of everything, you know, I mean, or just like a general approach. I mean, it's a combination of, again, having a great location. I mean, that the entire mountain that we were up on, I mean, there were all kinds of different looks and environments, and our production designer and our locations people and Andrew and I we just scouted the hell out of it. And cause it's fun. You get to ride around and find everything is amazing in every direction. So you're just trying to sculpt, you know, the visual language of the piece. And then it's a question of pace, and it's a question of how we frame it and how you light it. And then I think on a story level, it's about, you know, the thing that you're waiting to happen that you know is going to happen, but you don't know how it's going to happen necessarily. And so it's just, you know, working with the actors in a way that they are kind of lost in the moment, and we can tightly, you know, tighten the screws a little bit. Yeah.
I would just draft on that. I mean, tone is David's specialty, I think, but I think one of the cool things was that we're in this forest, and one of the diversities, there were other places, other candidates to shoot this movie, other places that we considered. And I think one of the things that really sets the tone in a lot of ways is the kind of trees. Like, we traipsed all over these mountains. And what was crazy is that, I mean, I've never really thought of a forest. I hiked and camped and shot in the woods and all kinds of stuff. And there were so, I don't know if it's always like this because I've never had this in mind, but we were looking for specific different kinds of trees, some that were bare, some that had some branches on them, some that were stripped of their bark, some that had super lush foliage, some that were really dense and you couldn't see through. I mean, there were probably 15, maybe 10 different kinds of areas, so much so to the point that the very first day that we shot was actually 4 hours beyond where we were going just for this very unique forest that was in the caldera. It like had these very shallow roots in the caldera of this volcano. So the trees were all really short, had this kind of like reddish, very thin, these thin branches. And we shot a rad, you know, shot of as Luke kind of comes out and he comes into this forest. He thinks at the top of the mountain, he comes out into this wooded area and the trees look different. And the ground was like, we couldn't capture this, but the ground was spongy. I mean, you like your foot would sink into it.
It was this weird moss. It was like you're running, you know, on a carpet in the forest.
A thick carpet.
Is that the scene where he sees a hand?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That was that's so it. Good.
Yeah. That was day one for us.
That was day one.
But yeah, we're just really striving for different looks because someone had said, I think one of the producers had said, a wood is a wood, meaning once you shoot a movie in the woods, it all just becomes like a visual mesh in a sense, and you stop seeing it as an audience, which happens a lot. Filmmakers talk about it when they go to the jungle, and they like, the jungle's an amazing place to go, but it's hard to photograph in a way. And so we were trying to avoid that as much as possible.
Right on. Anyone have...
Well, can we talk about the Jatoon? Is that how you say Jatoon?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk
monster.
About.
It.
That guy.
The Jotun.
Yeah, if you could show that, Steve. Oh, my God.
So... Is that actually how it's described in the book, or how was the creature developed? And that was all CGI, right? Or was that practical as well?
It's a combination of both. So it's a little different in the book. We definitely took license in the movie, but in the book, it's kind of the experience of reading a book is that every time you read about it, it's authored a little bit differently, and your imagination has to produce it. So it's always, I find that when you read a monster in a book, it's like it's always kind of changing a little bit in my mind. The same way when you conjure a character, their face may change in your imagination as you go through the course of the book. And so we had to literalize that, and so we were very fortunate to have Keith Thompson come on board, who's a really incredible artist, and so we riffed back and forth on some different ideas. And there is a Jotnar clan in Norse mythology of shape-shifting gods, basically, and it really fit into our mythology, and which we had to narrow a little bit from the book. And it kind of, we thought it gave us license to do some interesting stuff. And so a lot of what Keith does that I really find compelling is, mixtures of human forms with animal forms, in a sense, or mm-hmm. really playing with those ideas, in a sense. And, not unlike the Cronenberg stuff that you were referencing earlier. It's just there's a part of your brain that recognizes the human body specifically in human mm-hmm. faces. And when you mess with that and turn it upside down a little bit, you just get that uncanny, unsettling sensibility. And so when Keith tossed this design by, I was just completely blown away. And so we put them all up on the wall, and this was the one we'd come in every day and go, man, I wish we could do that. And then you go, well, why can't we do that? You know, what are movies? And let's do the crazy thing. Let's just go for it. But that was the birth of the design. And yeah, there was a digital element, but there was also a giant prosthetic monster head that Josh and Sierra Russell of Russell Effects here in LA, which worked, they did the body work for us on Southbound. They built a full size head and shipped it to Romania, and it had a
very delicately,
and it had a stunt performer that would fit inside of it. Whoa. So she was like on her stomach basically, okay. and the head fit around her, and then she would wear these like giant monster gloves, and she mm-hmm. would play the hands, and we would paint out her head, so her head would come out of what we called the cowl where the monster's eyes live.
It's awesome that it was a woman who was inside of it. Is the in the book, is it a woman, is it actually female, is the monster female as well? That's why I was thinking that's kind of interesting that you ended up using, because it kind of just melds together that the monster's also female. And one of the things I felt with the monster, I mean, I love like reading other interviews and how it was explained about the Norse god, but that doesn't It's interesting because you see this like wonderful like creature, and then you don't necessarily always get that kind of mythology in the film itself. Mm-hmm. So were there times where you were like, can we slip in this dialogue a little bit to kind of like expand on, like when he goes into that room and there's these worship, it's like a church going on, church and everything mm-hmm. like that. So were there times where you were like trying to interweave into the script to kind of, instead of, you know, because you always have those moments in scary movies where it's like, let me tell you everything that's happening, and I can like make it not scary anymore. So it was mm-hmm. great that you left the mystery, but there were times where you were like, everyone needs to know this wonderful backstory to this monster. How do we do that without giving it all away?
It's always the bargain. You know, you're always sitting there, both on the writing front and in post, you're just going, what is too much mm-hmm. to say? It will always be scarier if it's left unknown in a sense, but we take something with us at the end of these films too. There's something left for us to look deeper into, and so I also think comprehension is one of the hardest things to maintain when you're making a movie, because you just, once you've looked at something five times, you understand it differently. Once you've looked at it 400 times or 2,000 times, it becomes very mutant what you're looking at to understand. Is it clear? Or am I being too clear? Am I being too overt? So, a lot of care went into trying to figure out what was the right amount of information to supply what was a somewhat dense mythology that had to fit at the end of this movie. You know, that was kind of part of the design of the whole project, in a sense. So how do we, again, to your point, how do you give them enough without giving them too much, was definitely, that was the tightrope that we were trying to maneuver, in a sense. But I'm happy that the people that like the monster have really gotten behind it, and there's been a lot of art on the internet and people designing their own versions of the monster and stuff. And that's great for us, I think, because you do go, okay, so the spirit of this thing can live on in its own way and in other imaginative scenarios, hopefully.
Also, you put so much time and thought into the beast, into all the kind of, like, as we went through different iterations of what the design was, what we're going to be able to do physically, motion capturing, movement. There were so many different studies that went into that, watching giraffes running. Mm. I mean, like, there was a ton of work, so it's validating that like people pick up and they're like, oh, it's actually like I can kind of read the depth of this story, of this just this one concept.
Mm-hmm. It's cool too, because the monster belongs so much to, you know, it belongs to Adam Neville, but it also, you know, you have all these different components that bring it to life. You know, we mentioned our SFX friends that did the head, but you also, I just quickly spot, like, we had an amazing VFX supervisor, Ben White, who was doing a lot of the giraffe work. He was the one who, they show up a little deeper for us in production and have to conceptualize how to do the CG renderings out in that environment. And it was his team of artists that really capture a lot of the nuances of its behavior in the woods. And we were able to kind of supply them with some reference material on that, because the movie's produced by Andy Serkis, and his production company, of course, has the resources to do awesome mocap. So in post, we had two mocap actors playing the monster, and they are connected by, they call it a foam noodle. It's basically like a pretend spine. Ooh. And so they're sitting in a room behaving as the monster, running around, and the person in the front is playing, you know, the head hands of it. And so I got to kind of direct this, you know, these into the shots. Awesome. And provide, you know, reference material for the animators, in a sense. And you get a little bit more intimate with, well, it looks real goofy if we do this, but what if what if you do it a little bit more like this and that stuff? So yeah,
that's interesting. Fun.
But also, this is like, we could spend a whole hour just talking about this piece, because there's so much thought and care and time went into it. But one thing that David was really keen on was having a physical aspect on the set, which was super valuable, not only to spare us from doing some visual effect shots when we're shooting over it, but also so just we could like all wrap our heads around the space and the size and the height of the thing and where's the hand go and all that kind of stuff. And then the physics, like the mechanics of having a girl inside of this thing, she has to be suspended by wires because the beast is 12 feet tall. So the hands come down to about 8 feet, and you're, you know, so you have to get the right angle. And then we had our stunt team basically built this kind of tray that she could sit in, and she could like sit in for a length of time so she wouldn't have to keep getting out of it. And then we were able to have her on a ladder at one point, but Josh and Sierra, who you guys should have on the show because they're awesome and do a ton of horror.
Okay.
They
that's our effects
hell
team.
Yeah.
They're like must have. But anyway, they built this rad head foam, and it was super impressive and insanely detailed. And so that was a reference. It was something we were able to shoot over, sprayed it down with glycerin, and also make it look good, but also just to kind of orient the whole thing. And in two particular cases, we had, you know, the actresses on wires. We had the head on wires. The head is on a descender rig with her in it. This is the foam head, so we can shoot over it. We had a crane that we're shooting with over a crane that had the helmet. I mean, it was we did some wire work as it's moving across the camera.
With Rafe
on it.
Spall in his pajamas with the Norse battle axe underneath it. You know, and it's 4 a.m. And it's snowing above us, and we hope it doesn't catch on, you know, and you're like, man, I hope this works.
Yeah.
My God, that is intense.
It was involved for a movie this scale.
Yeah.
But yeah, you pulled it off, and it looked fantastic.
Absolutely.
My God. The way it moved, too. Like, I noticed specifically today when I was watching it, like, the way it ran towards him.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it just looked so... It was majestic, but terrifying because of how natural it looked. It didn't look clunky at all.
Well, that's the giraffes.
Yeah, I was about to say. It was like giraffe, kind of like moose, like dog-like. It was just... Oh, it was a sight to behold, I gotta say. And that was one of my favorite aspects of the film as well. Like, I love creatures and monsters. Like, again, the thing, like, is like the shit for me, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And so just seeing that, I was just like, oh, this is so beautiful. And also that shot of it, like, with the fire in the barn, and you have it in its full entirety, and it's holding up, like, that lady.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, that's so beautiful to me. Ah, I gotta say, unfortunately, we have to wrap now. So before we do that, you'll go ahead and... tease any future projects or projects that you'd like to bring to attention that you have going on.
I can't really get into at the moment, but it's great that you referenced all the old work. Like, I just say to people, no, thank you. I mean, if anybody wants to check out, you know, especially The Signal, I feel like that one has a life and is very relevant to 2018.
I gotta say,
in terms of media overstimulation, and you know, in the context of social media gone awry, which I would say is indicative of the moment. I think it's all kind of relevant. But yeah, I'd throw that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same. I'd say, you know, the vault we just did was a good one. Proud of it. And I do a bunch of commercial stuff and sort of active in the immersive space. So a bunch of VR stuff. So
okay,
look out for it.
Right on. Thank you. And so, Andrew, you can be found at A Schollkind, right, on Twitter. And David, you're on Brooke Machina?
Yeah.
right on. Brooke Machina. So follow them on Twitter, support them and everything, and then catch their future works and also their past works that they just stated. And Chauncey, can you start pulling us over?
Oh, well, you can find me on Twitter at Miss Chauncey KR, and also I do horror movie reviews at Bloody Breakdown on my YouTube, which you can find the link to on my Twitter at Miss Chauncey KR.
Yes, guys, I'm Oliver Jen. Follow me on all social media platforms at Ollie Dreamer, and you can always check me out on AfterBuzz TV for the Top Model After Show.
And my name's Carrie Lane. You can find me online at Carrie D. Lane. And tune in at 6 p.m. today. We have the premiere of AfterBuzz Anime Reviews. We're talking about Kakegurui, episodes 1 through 6. And, yeah, it's going to be fun.
And you'll probably hear my voice on that show because I'm going to be engineering that. But, yeah, so join us for that as well. Also, I'd like to tease Meet the Movie Press. It's every week. Insiders Simon Thompson and Jeff Snyder break down all the industry biggest news stories, from the box office numbers to celebrity updates. Sometimes serious, sometimes funny, but always credible. Meet the Movie Press is the ultimate podcast for movie junkies, and subscribe on iTunes and listen on demand, or tune in live at 9 a.m. every Friday, only on the Popcorn Talk Network. See you there. And I also engineer that show. It's a lovely show. It's great. I love it. Also, we're doing a giveaway. So for the Ritual book here, we had them sign it. So what you do is you go to wherever you listen to our podcast, and if you watch us on YouTube, here's what you do. You leave a review of our show, and you try to take a picture of it, screenshot it, email it at us at horrormovienewsptn@gmail.com. Again, horrormovienewsptn@gmail.com with your screenshot of the review. And you can also tweet your picture of the review and tag our show at horrornewsptn. And we will announce the winner next week. And again, my name is Anthony Becerra. You can find me everywhere at TonyBTony_. And that will do it. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Really appreciate everything you guys said. And yeah, that's a wrap. Let's do it.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.